This sounds horrible, but do you ever wonder what it would be like if you and your wife were separated by something bigger? Like death, like her death?
I have given it a fair amount of thought.
Not in any painful way, but just like a gentle floating off.
It's gotta be peaceful. I mean, this is the mother of your children.
And then the new wife would be great.
God, I can't wait to meet my second wife.
Hello, and welcome to The Collision, Collider's podcast about movies, TV, and more. I'm the site's managing editor, Matt Goldberg, and with me, as always, are associate editors Adam Chitwood.
Howdy.
And Dave Trumbor.
Hello.
Today we'll be talking about Judd Apatow, how he has changed comedy, where he is with his career, and his new film, This Is 40. So, Adam brought up an interesting point about how comedy has changed over the course of the past couple decades in terms of film comedies, and Apatow has been a big part of that. And Adam, would you like to sort of explain a little bit more about what you mean in terms of how comedy has changed?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at kind of like the comedies of the 90s, a quote-unquote comedy film seemed to be kind of like in the kind of high concept area. You know, you had like Galaxy Quest, American Pie, Austin Powers. There were like your sex comedies, and then there were like people in costumes comedies. It was always kind of outlandish and kind of something that was over the top and played for laughs. And even stuff coming out of SNL, like Superstar, and stuff like that. And then with the 40-Year-Old Virgin, it was kind of just a story about normal everyday people. And kind of, he kicked that off, but also the improv style of comedy where there's a script, but the script is not, it's not golden. You don't have to stick to the script completely. And that's where we got a lot of kind of the most quotable lines from the 40-Year-Old Virgin. And that kind of kicked off this stream of not only comedies that were kind of basically about everyday life and normal life, but also comedies where the hero was maybe kind of like the nerdier person or the geek.
There was a film called Revenge of the Nerds.
there was, but that was played very, very highly towards the stereotype. This was more of like the Seth Rogen, the knocked up, the schlub, or, you know, super bad. The guys that weren't, these aren't kids in like, you know, pants up to their belly button and glasses with, you know, tape in the middle of them. They're just kind of kids that are kind of on the fringe. I would say it goes back to Freaks and Geeks, the creation of Freaks and Geeks, and where, you know, that show had the geeks, but it also the freaks, which was kind of a group of, you know, individuals that wasn't necessarily being portrayed on screen very often. You know, it was always the jocks and then the nerds. And with Apatow and Paul Feig, Freaks and Geeks is Paul Feig's baby. He created it, and Judd Apatow certainly had a heavy hand in that. But that it really showed the side of, like, you know, the James Franco character and everything, and Linda Cardellini and everyone like that. It was just a different kind of character that we didn't normally see
in
films.
You can sort of see that evolve to Undeclared.
Yeah, and exactly, Undeclared too. And nowadays, like, you know, we see comedies now, they're not just the, the high concept thing, like the 5-year engagement. So that's just about people, and it's a comedy. I mean, you still have the kind of like Wanderlust or something like that where it's a little more outlandish, but it's just kind of interesting that the concept of like a quote-unquote high concept comedy has kind of changed. It used to be just, you know, like Austin Powers, you know, if I want to go see a comedy, it's going to be people in costumes or something really crazy.
Right. Well, no, I mean, you also bring up a good point in terms of the ensemble, in terms of an ensemble comedy. Even though these new films have lead roles, back in the 90s, it really was like, this is a Michael Myers movie. He's going to dress up and play a kooky character, whether it's, you know, Wayne from Wayne's World, or it's Austin Powers, or Eddie Murphy, he was the lead. And then the only sort of people doing ensemble stuff in a big way was Christopher Guest, being for Guffman and Best in Show and things like that. So with you had that side of it. But again, with Apatow comes along, and also sketch comedy. So not just Wanderlust, but The State has that impact to do Wet Hot American Summer and build off what they're doing. So now it's become more about the ensemble. Even though SNL obviously is a sketch comedy troupe, Lorne Michaels was always about picking out individual characters and actors and trying to build on them rather than – there's never been an SNL movie as opposed to a Reno 911 movie or a movie with everyone from The State. things like that. And again, we did have sort of like SCTV comedies, kind of like Strange Brew, and but you're right, Adam. It's still more very high concept, like Three Amigos or stuff like that. And occasionally you'd get like a National Lampoon movie. Like Vacation is very much about normal people, but it, that's not an ensemble.
And even,
that's a
even Animal Chase. Even Animal House.
Yeah, even Animal House. But even though Animal House is an ensemble, but like Vacation is a Chevy Chase vehicle.
Yeah.
And while 40-Year-Old Virgin is ostensibly, it's a Steve Carell film, it does feel more like an ensemble. Like, Judd Apatow films have leads, but they really feel more like a group effort, where if someone's got the ball and they're running with it, even if it doesn't advance the story or help out the main character, if you have Seth Rogen and Paul Rudd doing You Know How I Know You're Gay, you will run that for as long as you can get that joke to go. And as long as you're getting laughs out of it. And it works, even though from a narrative standpoint, it's completely unnecessary.
Well, and also those ensembles build – those serve as launching pads for huge careers. I mean, Anchorman was the birth of Steve Carell.
Well, that 40-year-old virgin
you had
was like – Anchorman was kind of the notice, and then the following year, 40-year-old Virgin launched him to the A-list.
Yeah. Well, I'm saying that these smaller players in the ensemble, you know,
oh, absolutely.
Apatow or whoever,
absolutely.
They let them shine, like Seth Rogen and Jason Segel also. Jason Segel in Knocked Up, leading to Forgetting Sarah Marshall. Superbad, you know, well, I guess Superbad was the leading roles of Jonah Hill and Michael Cera. But see
Seth
that
– Rogen helped make that. That was
– Yeah, and
that
and by
– co-wrote it with Evan Goldberg.
Yeah, and by making this ensemble the star of the movie instead of just one person the star of the movie, it allows – you see these burgeoning stars, and you look back years later, you're like, oh, wow, like Seth Rogen was, you know, just kind of sidekick number three in 40-Year-Old Virgin, and now he's a huge star.
Right. So there is that element to it of – you're right. It's absolutely right. It's now a launching pad in a way that – for instance, Patton Oswalt was talking about, because he's been doing comedy for a long time, and sort of – there was a trajectory for comedians, and the trajectory was, you know, you do your stand-up, you get on Carson, and then you either land a TV show or start doing movies. Like, that was the path, and that kind of all started, and then that basically fell apart. That model, when The Tonight Show vanished, that model vanished, and so it kind of had to readjust and find new ways to exist, and the current model we're seeing is you're coming out of the ensemble. There's very few stand-up comedians. There's no Eddie Murphy anymore, not really. I mean, people who do stand-up comedy still go into ensembles. Like Aziz Ansari he started out as a comedy troupe. He started out with Human Giant, with Paul Scheer and Rob Hubel, but he does stand-up, and yet he's part of a great ensemble in Parks and Rec. And I think just to take a brief aside, TV has become, and it's always been a bit of a launching pad, but especially now where actors can kind of hone their craft. I mean, yeah, Steve Carell had his movie career helped launch by Anchorman and 40-Year-Old Virgin, but he was always getting weekly notice on The Office, which was a huge successful television show. So people –
and to go even further, The Daily Show. I mean, The Daily Show –
oh, yeah, and The Daily Show as well. The Daily Show has become a launching pad. You're right. So things like that, there's more avenues now, it seems, to get to that comedy as maybe it was a bit more limiting before in terms of who could be a comedy star.
Mm-hmm.
Especially because, as you say, Adam, now we're accepting actors who kind of play just, quote-unquote, normal people, like things of that nature, rather than the high-concept comedy.
Yeah, in order to pitch a comedy, you don't have to say – or like you don't have to come in and say, okay, here's the character. Like here's the grab. It can just be –
it can't, it doesn't have to be de-derp-de-derp, but then suddenly
– Rob Schneider.
It really is. All Rob Schneider is like quote-unquote – people understand. Like when we say high concept, it's not complimentary. High concept is simply really a such-and-such meets such-and-such. That really is the basis. Like when Die Hard was a huge success, everything – all action movie pitches were Die Hard in a blank. And to the point where I think someone was like, it's Die Hard in a building. So.
Rob Schneider is a woman.
Rob Schneider is a carrot. We can do that all fucking day. So, but now we have also, I think what Apatow has wrought, especially in the films he produces, is this love of improvising. And I think there are people in his circle, like Will Ferrell, who is around Apatow's age, and they basically co-founded. They helped to found Funny or Die, them and Adam McKay, something along those lines.
Yeah, Adam McKay is very much Will Ferrell's partner in crime.
Yeah.
They wrote together. He wrote all of Will Ferrell's characters on SNL.
Exactly. But I was talking, I was doing press for the campaign, and apparently their original cut is like 4 hours long, simply because Will Ferrell can just riff forever. And because the cameras now are all digital, there's no time limit anymore. Before, when we're, you know, back when film was the norm, it was actually more prohibitive, because you can't just film is expensive, and you can't just wait all day letting your actor riff. But now that the technology has changed, you can have a scene in Wonderlust, which is for what feels like 10 solid minutes of Paul Rudd just go, get on my dick, on my dick, get on my dick, which is a fine scene. But that shit would never have happened in the mid-90s, not even close. You know where Paul Rudd was doing in the mid-90s? Fucking Clueless.
That's not a bad movie.
Not at all, but Nazi would never... That's the kind of movie. Clueless is
that and
Clueless
Romeo and
is yeah, like well Clueless is high concept. It's Emma set in a high school. That's what it is.
Yeah. Dave, any thoughts to offer?
I don't really have a whole lot to talk about. I'm not a big fan of Apatow's style, to be honest.
No,
with
it's fine.
We're just talking about comedies in general and what, you know, what Apatow has brought.
But I mean this whole thing, it's more like it's more dramedies. They become dramedies. Like, when you actually publicize this and market this as a comedy by showing, you know, all the funny little one-liners and all the funny scenes in your marketing material, and then you have, you know, a two-hour movie where it's more just, like you said, just watching kind of normal people that have a lot of drama but some funny moments.
Well, I think...
To me, it's not my kind of comedy. I do like 40-Year-Old Virgin.
I was going to say, I think 40-Year-Old Virgin and Knocked Up are legit comedies, but Funny People and This Is 40 are dramedies. And those films, I think, are much more personal to Judd Apatow. Those are more autobiographical.
Yeah, for him and for the people involved that are making it, too, you can kind of tell, you know, what things were sort of on their mind or in their career that they wanted to get out and just sort of have this catharsis.
Adam Sandler's I make shitty movies, but I'm going to keep making shitty movies.
Yeah, pretty much.
So, yeah, there's still room for that 90s character. That's Adam Sandler. Adam Sandler persists, and if Eddie Murphy...
If it was an Adam Sandler from the 90s, but not Adam Sandler as of late, to see him go back to...
Oh, absolutely. No, I would love to see another Happy Gilmore or Billy Madison, but that dude is dead.
Apatow and Smigel wrote You Don't Mess With a Zoan, which is very much pre-Apatow high-concept comedy.
Oh, yeah.
Which is kind of interesting.
But they also did, like, weird stuff. Like, didn't Apatow... I think Apatow wrote The Cable Guy.
Yeah, and Heavyweights.
definitely Heavyweights. I'm glad we brought that.
Well, Apatow's had a really varied career. I mean, he was a writer on the Ben Stiller Show. The guy's been in the trenches for a long while, and he's sort of seen the best and the worst of it. I have to give him credit for one of the best things he's ever done as a consulting producer was The Critic. The Critic is one of the best shows ever. And I can't help but wonder if The Critic had the same run as The Simpsons. Like, if The Critic were still on the air today, like, what could they do? Because films are always changing in terms of, I don't know, I think The Critic would still be amazing.
Well, and I also think, even if you don't like Apatow's films, I think that one of the greatest things that he's done is kind of shepherd these young careers. Like, forgetting Sarah Marshall, and I know Dave said he doesn't like the dramedy aspect of it, but what these, like, Forgetting Sarah Marshall, Superbad, Pineapple Express, these are all really funny movies, but they also have a point. Like, these are real characters, and they have heart. Like, Superbad is a really sweet, like, almost a love story between two high school, like, best friends, which, I mean, it sounds weird to say it like that, but, I mean, it's really kind of a sweet story. Pineapple Express, I don't know if it's that sweet, but it's fucking hilarious.
Well, no, but again, it's helping to shepherd... He was a producer. He produced it, and again, he's discovering talent. He discovered Seth Rogen. He discovered all these guys that are now superstars. We just saw a trailer for This Is the End, and at least half, if not most of that cast has been involved with Judd Apatow in some way.
Mm-hmm.
And it's that kind of thing. And it's almost to the point where he created this little troupe, this impromptu yeah. troupe that has the same kind of comic sensibilities. So he sort of become the father of it in a weird way, even though he's never been an actor.
Well, and they've all said that in the very beginning when, like, when they were on Freaks and Geeks, Jason Segel sat down with him and he said, you know, I want to do, like, big movies. And Judd Apatow said, you have to write. You have to learn how to write. You have to write it because no one's going to give you what you want. Like, the types of roles that you really want to do, because, you know, we saw with Forgetting Sarah Marshall that, you know, Jason Segel's sensibilities are a lot more on the softer and sweet side. And so that's what, I mean, and that's what he's done. I know Seth Rogen was, like, one of the main writers on Undeclared. As well as appearing in it too.
Right.
So all of these guys, I think Jay Baruchel has been writing as well. All
yeah,
of these guys.
He wrote Goon.
I mean, yeah, and it's and from what I've read from all these guys and stuff, it seems to me that Judd Apatow has been like telling them, you know, kind of showing them the ropes of how do you write a screenplay and kind of helping them along.
And now it's sort of expanding to actresses, really funny actresses are sort of mm-hmm. running with that now. So Kristen Wiig writing her character in Bridesmaids, or Rashida Jones writing her character in Celeste and Jesse Forever, where they're like, no one is definitely handing us good roles, so we have to fight like a motherfucker for that shit. And when they do, they get great characters out of it. So they know how to write for themselves. And so, because again, with Apatow, yes, he's done great stuff, but his stuff is also very male-oriented, for sure.
Yeah.
Although, then again, I think Leslie Mann in his movies, you know, they are married, but she does fantastic work, and although I'm sure she has input into it, it's not like she's his fucking hand puppet. And he's like, I'll give you great lines, honey. Like, she's a smart woman. She can act and all that stuff. But again, it's cool to see sort of actresses now sort of, I don't want to say catching up, but we have seen more of a male-dominated field in these comedies until recently. So Kristen Wiig and Paul Feig's Bridesmaids, and I'm looking forward to The Heat a lot. That new trailer, that Red Band trailer was awesome.
Yeah, the Red Band definitely did that joke, some more service.
That joke at the end of the trailer just destroyed me. Oh, gosh. So, yeah, I mean...
Yeah, Red Band's the way to go with that. And that actually kind of brings up, it's a rough segue, but it brings up an interesting point, that these guys do a lot of sort of the temporary, the preview screenings, and they sort of tweak their process based on sort of audience reactions, things like that, too. And I'm wondering, because we know they're going to have a lot of deleted scenes, even in This Is 40 that came out, there was an extended scene that rolled after the credits. I don't even know.
It's just, yeah, it's just Melissa McCarthy.
Just one straight scene.
Non-stop.
Yeah, just constantly.
And that's emblematic of so many scenes.
Yeah.
And, I mean, here's the funny thing about, and it's not new, Anchorman, there is another movie that they were able to make out of Anchorman simply from deleted scenes. They had it was basically the original film, and then they decided to create a new plot on a whim, but they basically created a new movie and had an entire other film called Wake Up Ron Burgundy.
It's like a plot with Maya Rudolph.
Yeah, it's almost like exactly. There is more than one Anchorman movie out there if you want to see it. And it's not bad. It's not amazing, and it's tied together heavily through narration because it has to be, but it's still, there's some very good stuff in there. Like there's an extended scene where if you've seen The Legend of Ron Burgundy, you know that Champ has a crush on Ron, but Wake Up Ron Burgundy is so much heavier, and there's a scene that goes on and on and on.
With him professing his love to Ron in the car, and Will Ferrell and Paul Rudd just ignore everything he says and pretend like he's not saying these just really sexual things about what he would do to Ron.
I know. So sometimes it works. See, that's the thing. This is the conundrum that Judd Apatow and his colleagues sort of put us in, because on the one hand, their movies are running very, very long. Because the way they're doing it is they're riffing forever, and then, as Dave said, they're test screening them just like a stand-up comedian would, in terms of you go from city to city, you work different rooms, and you try out material and see what gets laughs. And Judd Apatow, I remember when he was doing press for The 40-Year-Old Virgin, he said that the test screening process was incredibly helpful for them. A lot of directors don't like test screenings because they just know what they want, and then having to adjust it to what they feel is the lowest common denominator affects their vision. Whereas for a comedian, they love that feedback, and it has been useful. Like, there's that one scene, I remember Apatow was talking about the scene in 40-Year-Old Virgin where Elizabeth Banks is using a showerhead to, like, masturbate in front of Steve Carell, and they're watching it, and it's not getting a lot of laughs, and they're realizing, oh, wait, we've gone too far. This is really awkward. So the way they fixed it is they put in a little insert of Steve Carell going, this is graphic. And all of a sudden, the scene works. So you can tweak things and make it better. But at the same time, now you're going from feedback of, if everything is getting laughs in these text screenings, why would I want to cut any of it?
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Like, these scenes are really funny. Like, the scene in Anchorman is hilarious. And the thing is, like, you get these super talented comedians in a room, and they're really, really funny. But it doesn't make for a cohesive movie sometimes. It just makes for a weird experience. It doesn't feel like one movie.
No, it doesn't. It feels like a cobbling together of scenes. And sometimes that works. Anchorman really is a cobbling together. There is a loose plot about Ron being afraid of losing his job and finding to get it back. But the whole, like, news fight just coming out of nowhere.
I think that's more Adam McKay's sensibilities than Anchorman. Oh, sure. But, I mean, you can see it in The Other Guy where it's just so ridiculous that it works.
Oh,
it
absolutely.
It's going over the line.
But again, we're talking about, like, something where every scene counts for the narrative. And other directors do that. Like, The Hangover, every scene, there's no extraneous scenes in that movie. It's all about driving the plot forward and finding Doug. For Anchorman, it's like, if we have something that works and we know it, we're going to use it. And that's great, because I think Adam McKay is more successful, well, for the most part. I think the flip side of Anchorman is Talladega Nights. I think Talladega Nights, that's a perfect example of riffing going on far too long. Most of that film is just riffing.
It's a little too long. I don't love that movie, but I don't think it's as kind of meandering.
See, I don't think it's very
some of the other Apatow movies.
To me, I like sort of set up punchline jokes in a way. I mean, it's cool if they riff or something, but at some point the actors just kind of get locked in a thing where they're just riffing. They're just sort of going back and forth trying to top each other, and the scene actually isn't setting up jokes anymore. Whereas, so I like in Step Brothers where, yes, there is riffing, but it's more situational comedy. So when they're trying to stop the house from being sold, they're setting up new scenarios.
I'm just thinking,
I'm thinking of
scenarios.
That scene.
Yeah.
Eat shit, Derek. But yeah, so, but again, there's another movie. Like, that movie helped launch Adam Scott as well. Now he's rolling with it. So
yeah, he's fantastic.
Exactly. So we see these films and they're a mixture, and it's interesting because Apatow kind of set the tone, him and McKay, and I think McKay has been more successful with it, but Apatow sort of laid out this world, and now it feels like he is falling behind in it. Like, he's making different, I like the fact that he's making the movies he wants to make, but as far as being a comedian, as far as telling jokes, I think he is losing the thread, and he's just, as a storyteller, it's not working for him as well anymore.
Well, like, the thing I've noticed most is that he's trying so hard to be James L. Brooks and Cameron Crowe, and he's not. And
if he wants to be Cameron Crowe, he should add more classic rock songs.
Yeah, well, he's long said that James L. Brooks is his hero, and you know, he said that he test screens his movies for James L. Brooks and Cameron Crowe a lot.
I wouldn't go to James L. Brooks anymore.
How
do you know?
How do you know?
Oh God!
But it just feels weird, like going from The 40-Year-Old Virgin. I wouldn't have necessarily pegged that as like saying like oh, this filmmaker is really, you know, going for like a James L. Brooks sensibilities. You really
I've
started
never
to see
seen
that in
from,
Funny People.
Really, yeah, Funny People kind. Yeah, I can see that in his more dramatic stuff.
Yeah, but it's just kind of interesting to see, because, I mean, you know, 40-Year-Old Virgin, very joke-oriented, also has a heart. Knocked Up, very joke-oriented, has, you know, a little more of a heart. And then Funny People is when he really put it into gear and said, you know, I'm going to make my James L. Brooks movie. I'm going to try and toe that line between
trauma.
I'm
not only going to make a James L. Brooks movie, I'm going to make a Judd Apatow movie and put them on top of each other into one gigantic movie.
Well, it's just been kind of interesting to see his, like, career go that way, and I think this one... This Is 40 is, you know, kind of even further in the – he wants to make an equal parts drama and comedy. And I'm just kind of interested to see where else he goes, because his producerial efforts are so different from that. I mean, his if you look at his directorial films, especially This Is 40 and Funny People, they are not Superbad or, you know, Pineapple Express or even Bridesmaids.
No, those are very more like sophomoric comedies. Yeah. There's gross out humor and all mm-hmm. that good stuff. And you're right, these newer movies have a lot more drama. They're more, quote-unquote, mature. As far as a movie where Paul Rudd asks Leslie Mann to look up his asshole.
But I feel like this movie was actually fairly... I want to say fairly realistic, very honest.
Sure.
But to a point where, yeah, it was literally just like watching a 40-year-old married couple and their family.
Yeah, it was
really all it was.
It really did
watching,
feel
like a family reunion.
It felt personal to the point of Judd Apatow has turned his home movies into a film and cast Paul Rudd as him and all credit to him. If I were in a movie, if I were making a movie, I would want Paul Rudd to play me. Because who wouldn't? Paul Rudd is awesome.
And who doesn't like Paul Rudd?
No one, yeah, everyone loves Paul Rudd. But maybe we should talk about This Is 40 in particular, because I think we're headed in that direction anyway, to sort of start talking about specifics, because I think that's the up and down of it. Adam, since you've been leading the conversation, you want to tell us as best you can what This Is 40 is about? Because it's not a plot-driven film.
Yeah, the loose semblance of a plot, it's a sort of sequel to Apatow's Knocked Up. It picks up with the characters played by Paul Rudd and Leslie Mann, Debbie and Pete, 5 years after the events of Knocked Up. They're both turning 40. Their birthdays are on the same week. Debbie is a little more freaked out about it, but that's really not what the movie is about. It's not about this like scariness of turning 40, as best as I can tell. It's basically just a portrait of a marriage and a portrait of family life. But all the interviews I've read in the creation of this movie, Judd Apatow and Paul Rudd, you know, put kind of came together with their wives and put all of their kind of marital struggles in one script. But what it feels like is watching all of the worst stuff, like all of the fights, all of the horribleness for 2 hours.
Right. It's like very, it's not just
very
like
little,
looking...
very little of the sweetness. Right. They kind of aired their grievances and like, oh, this is something I do that really annoys my wife.
Exactly. And I understand
And we got into this fight.
Right. I understand conflict is good. But it's nothing but – it's like you're stuck with an unhappy but hilarious marriage.
Yeah.
Everyone. They
have one scene where there's like a little bit of relief to that, and then they literally come right back into the thick of all their troubles. And there's no sense of relief after that whatsoever. Even the ending of this wasn't very satisfying. It was just kind of like they just kind of ended at a point where it was just this cycle, like it's just going to keep happening over and over again.
Yeah,
because that's married life.
Apparently.
And next year we'll find out that Judd Apatow and Leslie Mann have divorced.
I'm wondering, like, what people that are, like, in that situation, like, if they would have enjoyed the film more than I would.
I was talking
personally
with Steve, and his observation was, with people he's known, that if you are in that age, like, if you are above 40 and above, you love this movie and you relate to it so much, and if you're below that age, it really doesn't do that much for you. Like, you still laugh, but that's what I've heard. Like, it's all about...
John Favreau's review was, I'm living it.
Of course you fucking are, John Favreau. I'd be upset if you weren't living it.
Rich white people problems.
It's not even... I will say, yes, it is rich white people problems, but it never felt that way about it. Like, not in the same way that The Company Men felt. Like, The Company Men got on my nerves, where Ben Affleck is saying, like, we can't quit our membership to the country club. I know I've lost my job, but we have to keep paying our country club dues. Yeah, no, this
that
was...
sounds like Arrested Development.
Exactly. Exactly.
But this felt like at some point they were like, you know what, we should probably actually have some sort of a plot line in here, so how about financial troubles?
Financial troubles and the exact same financial trouble. Like, they're both they both own their businesses, so neither one is an employee, which I think is kind of... I would have thought it would have been interesting if one of them, like, worked in an office. Like, they weren't...
Yeah. Or either of them were a little more blue-collar, because, I mean, yeah, they both own their own business. They drive a Lexus and a Beamer. They have a decent-sized house. And they drum up all these sort of financial difficulties, but never actually do anything about it. They just kind of keep talking about it.
Right.
Yeah, so there's no conclusion to that.
I mean,
whatsoever.
Really, the whole point of the financial difficulties is to show how they don't talk about their financial difficulties to each other. It's like, this is a marriage, and we don't share with each other. It's like, well, then that's not good, is it? You should probably be more honest and upfront with each other.
I think it was an Apatow-produced film. I could be wrong. He might have written or even directed it. But The Fun with Dick and Jane? He wrote that.
Yes, he did.
That, at least, I mean, it wasn't, that one is a little off, too, but at least in that situation, they took financial difficulties, and that was the main crux of the plot that drove that whole thing. They literally lost everything down to their landscape lawn, which was, I think somebody came and actually repossessed their lawn. So that was more of a play on financial difficulties. This is 40, just kind of hinted at it, but never resolved any of it.
Right. Well, it's just part of the mishmash that's the movie, and the movie's just going for whatever it can get. It does feel so cobbled together with so many plot lines and scenes, just scenes that don't need to be there. Like, there's a scene in a swimming pool with Megan Fox getting hit on by Chris O'Dowd and Jason Segel, and they're just sort of just going back and forth. And, yeah, like, it's kind of funny. It's not amazing. And none of those characters, I mean, I guess you'd say that scene's like, well, that's a young people's game. And, like, you wouldn't, it's like, no, fuck that. Whatever. That scene is useless. In a film that is about being 40, I don't need that contrast. Let me live in it because we understand what their lives are. Especially, and that scene comes really late in the film, so it's even more useless.
Well, and my immediate reaction when it was over was that this would be an excellent Judd Apatow TV show. It felt like a full season of an Apatow TV show stretched to, like, fit into a feature film. Like, these, all of these individual episodes were make for really, really intriguing and honest television, but it does, it's just, as you said, it's a bunch of scenes hobbled together.
Yeah, you could,
there are episodes. There are literally episodes.
It is.
Like, they take the trip and then they come back. That's an episode.
Or, like, he's like, needs to loan money to his Paul Rudd's dad is played by Albert Brooks, and he's secretly loaning his dad money, and his dad has way too many kids for his age, and so there's that, and then there's the financial difficulties, and then they're like, is my employee stealing from me? So you're absolutely right. It feels very much like a television series condensed, just like I think Funny People feels like two movies, and one of them is good.
Yeah.
Well, and also another thing that really bothered me with This Is 40 is that, you know, these characters were likable and Knocked Up, but I had a real, like, Paul Rudd and Leslie Mann gave great performances, especially Leslie Mann, but they just, they got so mean. Like, it feels kind of mean-spirited. And I know, like, some of the sensibility about, like, having kids and everything is funny, and that's kind of like the way kind of me and my girlfriend talk about it, but to see it go on ad nauseum, it's just kind of mean-spirited and not fun.
Right. And I thought the kids were actually the best part of this film. I think they had some of the best sort of scenes and one-liners, and I think it was because it was a little more innocent. Like, even when the kids were kind of in each other's faces,
it's
that
innocent,
innocent
and
was
it's
real
actually
than sort of this manufactured meme.
It's funny. Improv is sort of the best way to handle child actors. If you free child actors dialogue, I remember I was doing like a press conference with Dustin Hoffman, and he was talking about working on Mr. Megorium's Wonder Emporium and how working with the kids on that, or the lead kid on that, was really good because it wasn't, as he said, a cereal box kid who's like, gee, Mom, this tastes great. Like, it was someone giving a real performance, which is difficult. And you can kind of see that in The Pursuit of Happiness with young Jaden Smith, who has no lines, but it's like, I'm going to give you the idea of this scene and you play it that way. And so surely for Maude Apatow and Iris Apatow, his real life daughters, it was just like, just do what you did this last weekend. Just do that for me, kids. You remember how you were behaving yesterday? Behave like that today on the set. And Maude Apatow or Iris, I forget which one's the older one, but she's really into watching Lost, so that's her thing.
That was one of the better jokes of the running joke of hers.
But it was, again, it was just like, where, like, Lost was how many years ago now that it ended? It just kind of came out
of
nowhere.
Oh, it ended like
just
3 years ago.
Apatow always injects that, like, pop culture thing, which is funny in the moment, but I'll always remember in one episode of The West Wing, you know, this is Aaron Sorkin talking, but Rob Lowe's character is critiquing some guy's speech, and he says, don't use pop culture references. Your right. speech is outdated within a week.
Right.
So, you know, you go back and watch Knocked Up, and they're all excited to go see Spider-Man 3, and you're like, wow, that movie blew. Because when Knocked Up came out, it was like everyone was really excited about Spider-Man 3, and it was like a thing, and it was everywhere. And now it's just like, oh,
you can have sort of a lasting joke in – there has to be like a date. Like if you can – something has to be probably 20 years old before you can reference it. So you get a great joke in The 40-Year-Old Virgin when they point out that he has framed an Asia poster.
Exactly. See, that kind of thing will always be funny because then most people just kind of look around like, who the fuck is Asia? Or what the fuck is Asia?
Exactly.
And that's what I miss about some of these like classic comedies. They knew that rule that like you can make fun of something that everybody knows about as long as it's far enough back in history that everybody will continue to know about it, not just the flavor of the week or something that happened earlier that year.
Yeah. And
because that makes it feel kind of episodic, like Adam was saying earlier.
Right, and it's a brief enough joke where you don't get bogged down in like,
exactly.
Like, what is Asia? Like, either you get the joke or you don't, and then you move on with your day.
Move on.
Also, if you ever plan on seeing Lost, finish the series before you go see This Is 40, if you haven't seen it, because it entirely spoils the ending.
Right. That was another thing. It's like, yeah, I don't know. And that's the thing, though, because Lost has been off the air for a few years. Maybe he felt like, well, I can get away with it now. But his daughter, who is wrapped up in technology, like, wouldn't she already know the ending of Lost? Wouldn't that have been talked about endlessly online?
Yeah.
I don't buy it.
It's just a strange kid. But
there are some things that I really do like in the film that I think address really interesting questions that other films in this sort of the difficulty of being parents haven't addressed. Apatow got there first. Like, how do you be a parent in the social networking age? Mm-hmm. And I think about that. I think about, like, thinking ahead to being a parent, and that just would keep me up at nights because nothing can prepare you for that at all. And I'm sure my parents, you know, like, with technology, like, that freaked them out about, like, oh, my God, I don't want them to play video games or watch television. And they didn't for a while, and I turned out really, really horribly. So parents, buy your kids a Nintendo when they're young or else they'll turn out like horrible people. So
I did think it was also really interesting how it explored their relationships with their parents, with Albert Brooks and John Lithgow, who were both – I felt like Albert Brooks was kind of under – or misused here. I love Albert Brooks, but he didn't quite pop.
He came off
kind of
like unlikable himself. Yeah, John Lithgow felt more honest and – yeah,
but these are both relationships that we haven't really seen play out on TV or in films, where it's kind of
the
like parent, you love
parents,
your parents,
yeah.
But you love your parents, but you know, at what point do you lay your foot down when you're the child? And
exactly,
you're both, adults?
You're both the child is now a parent as well, so you're in both arenas. And I agree. There's good stuff in This Is 40. I think half the movie works. The problem is there's another half
funny.
Of it. It is. It can
I
be.
I laughed a lot.
I didn't laugh as much. Like, there were times when I laughed pretty hard, and then there were times, like, there's the scene with Melissa McCarthy, who has a small role as the parent of a child that Leslie Mann bullies because that child was being mean to Leslie Mann's daughter in the film. So Melissa McCarthy plays this parent, and there's a parent-teacher conference, and Melissa McCarthy just goes off and says some really mean shit. And it's
See,
great.
But even that, to me, it was just like, I walked out, I was watching it in the credits, the extended scene, and they're cracking up on scene, and I'm just like, all right, just give me something else or just wrap this up, because it just got, it was more irritating.
Well, in the film, at least, it's fairly short. But again, like, look, I don't mind that stuff being in special features. And I think that's the issue here. We're seeing a lot of stuff that could easily be relegated to special features. And
yeah, I mean, I'll tell you exactly the point that I stopped laughing. It was when the fucking Philadelphia Flyers showed up on screen. And I was at that point.
When did that happen?
Are you kidding me? Fucking,
in the bar when they met
in the bar.
The hockey players.
Oh,
those are actually
okay.
Cool
oh, yeah. You should have just said the hockey players. I don't. The Philadelphia Flyers. Dave's hockey's in a fucking lockout right now, and no one gives a shit. And you're naming specific teams. It's like,
I absolutely hate the Flyers, so that took me out of this movie. Entirely.
Okay. Done. You're a Penguins fan, right?
Absolutely. Not that it matters this year.
No, it doesn't, and it never will. It never will matter. Hockey
what,
will never
Atlanta
come back.
Hockey team again? Oh, that's right, the one that won. Winnipeg, so.
As well they should. Hockey teams should be in places where people watch hockey, not in fucking Atlanta or Phoenix.
We are on the same page.
Yeah. We're going to stop talking about This Is 40 and talk about how to fix hockey, people. So first, what I think they need to do is
Riveting stuff.
Riveting. The Collision now is talking about sports. I like the one with the balls. So, yeah, this is 40. It's, I don't know. I don't even know what...
My friend was asking if I would recommend it, and I did. It's not a good movie, but I laughed, and I told him that it's worth seeing. I mean, if you want to fill out your Apatow filmography, but it's just, it's a weird movie.
It
doesn't have
it.
A plot. It's mean-spirited. Yeah. It's a weird
movie.
It's
so episodic.
But it's worth seeing.
No, it's
apparently.
Worth a rental, because when you rent it, you can pause it and get up and come back, and you won't have lost any of the pacing or anything. It's that episodic.
And as we said earlier, there's good stuff in there that hasn't really been explored that much before that I think is really... I don't know. I wish Apatow had someone else to... I wish he would... I mean, we were talking about this with Peter Jackson, when you get too successful for your own good. And I know Judd Apatow isn't incredibly egotistic. And I mean, I know he second-guesses himself as much as his fans do. But you kind of wish there were another pair of eyes that would come in and tell him, you know, take this out, this is good, expand on this.
Right. You just kind of hope maybe they'll be humbled. Although, how did This Is 40 do this weekend? Did it do all right?
Not great. It about half of what Knocked Up did, but Funny People didn't do amazing either.
Yeah.
I think I'm not sure if it was better than Funny People or not, but it's an adult comedy, so those usually have legs. I mean, The Hobbit dropped ridiculously.
It did? So, I hadn't checked the numbers. All I saw was that Jack Reacher did solid business.
Well, Hobbit was still number one, but it was the biggest, like, week-to-week, second-week drop in the, like, Lord of the Rings series.
Yeah, that's not surprising at all. So... there you go. We should have just talked about Jack Reacher for 40. I liked that movie.
I would have been okay with that.
Yeah. You let us astray, Adam. Why did we let you guide anything? You haven't seen Jack Reacher?
No, I want
to see Jack Reacher.
It's another one that was a little too long, but it was pretty well done.
Yeah, I don't know. At least it has good pacing, and it feels like a good action movie throwback. Like, I liked it. It felt like something that could have been made in the 90s. So there you go. The 90s weren't all bad, people. They weren't all bad. They were just mostly bad. No. Okay, let's skip to recommendations. Adam, since again, you've been sort of our guiding force for this podcast, why don't you kick it off?
I am recommending another James L. Brooks movie. I recommended Broadcast News last week. But I'm recommending his 1997 film, As Good As It Gets, because I think it exemplifies a lot of the things that This Is 40 got wrong and that it got a lot of things right. It doesn't have an easily discernible plot like This Is 40. It stars Jack Nicholson as kind of an OCD novelist who's a really mean guy, just an unlikable guy. And it's kind of about his relationship with this waitress at a cafe that he goes to every single day, sits in the same spot. Her son kind of has some medical issues. He has a neighbor who's a gay artist, played by Greg Kinnear, who kind of gets severely abused, but, you know, Jack Nicholson's character is a dick, and he's a dick to everybody. And it's kind of about, you know, him expanding his relationships with these two people, and I guess you could say it's a romantic comedy, but in As Good As It Gets, as bad as he is as a person and as mean-spirited as he is, it doesn't ever come off as something that you don't want to keep watching or something that kind of turns you off. There's other characters like Helen Hunt's character and Greg Kinnear's that are kind of good and kind of bring out, kind of lift things up, so you're not just kind of sitting in this, you know, mean-spirited place for 2 hours. Jack Nicholson won Best Actor for it. Helen Hunt won Best Actress. Kinnear was nominated for an actor. A lot of Oscars when it came out. It's kind of a rainy day watch. I wouldn't say it's one of the best films of all time, but
You wouldn't go that far to say it's one of the best films of all time.
It's a movie. It's got a
I get it. I just like that bar that you set for it. It's like, oh, it's not one of the best. Like, some guy listening to this podcast is like, but Adam, is it one of the best movies of all time? No? Well, then fuck you.
Not seeing it.
Okay. So, As Good As It Gets. Dave, what about you?
I'm going to recommend 1983's Trading Places. It came from a time when comedies were just comedies and they were actually funny. This one actually runs about 2 hours, too. So it's
the biggest old man comment. This was a time when comedies were funny.
I really am. I'm living in, like, the classic comedy, horror, everything eras these days. Like, I love this year in movies for new releases that came out, but I really, really just miss some of the classics. So if you haven't seen Trading Places, it's a John Landis film. Stars Eddie Murphy and Dan Aykroyd. Dan Aykroyd plays Lewis Winthorpe III. So as you can tell from that name, he's kind of a richy rich blue blood, and he works at the stock trading industry. He works for the Duke brothers, played by Ralph Bellamy and Don Ameche, who are two of the greatest villains, I think, in movie history. They basically decide to have sort of a social experiment. They want to see if people become successful either by basically nature versus nurture argument. So what they want to do is they want to take Lewis Winthorpe III, who's basically been given everything, born with a silver spoon, and just knock him down a number of pegs. Take everything from him, his house, his car, his life, his money, his girlfriend, his country club, everything. His cardigans, everything. And they want to see if he can figure out how to build his way back up and become successful. The counterpoint to this is they take a homeless person who's basically, it's Eddie Murphy, and he's basically pretending to be a war veteran to get, easy money. He's kind of a dirtbag. But he ends up being kind of a character that you kind of root for because he's just never been given any sort of benefit of the doubt. So for about half of this movie, those two are set against each other because the Duke brothers sort of now give Murphy's character all the benefits that Winthorpe's character had, and they see if he can become successful too. And meanwhile, this whole time, they're just sort of playing those two guys against each other. The great part of this film comes when Dan Aykroyd and Eddie Murphy's character actually end up cooperating together to take down the Dukes. And it's fantastically paced, plotted, written, everything film. There's a lot of humor in it, but they actually have a plot that has payoff at the end as well. And there's a nice cameo from Jamie Lee Curtis in there as well. So 1983's Trading Places. It also happens to have
a cameo from her. She's got she's the lead actress in that
film. Yeah, she's lead actress in that. So it also happens to be a great holiday film because it's centered around Christmas time. Not specifically, but just happens to take place at Christmas time. There's a great scene with Dan Aykroyd as a drunken belligerent Santa Claus. So if nothing else, check out 1983's Trading Places.
All right. I will be recommending 2007's Walk Hard: The Dewey Cox Story, which was written by Judd Apatow and Jake Kasdan. Kasdan also directed it. And Walk Hard came out around the same time that Walk the Line and Ray came out, which were incredibly formulaic biopics of Johnny Cash and Ray Charles, respectively. And they're not very good films, but they get Oscar nominations. But Walk Hard is just a great spoof. And that's what we don't see enough spoofs these days, and I'm not counting those shitty, Haunted House. Those aren't, they're spoofs, but they're awful. Walk Hard is a really good spoof. Spoofs music history. The film stars
Smart spoof.
It is. It's a smart spoof. It stars John C. Reilly as Dewey Cox, who is this, who gets to be this famous country folk singer. So he's more of in a Johnny Cash mode, but you see his rise and fall, and his true love is played by Jenna Fisher, but they can't be together because she's really religious. But it's just all these great things, these just little moments of understanding the genre and poking fun at it. Like, the movie starts out with that sort of takes off Ray, where in Ray Charles feels really guilty for his brother's death, and in Walk Hard, they're having a machete fight, and now Dewey accidentally cuts his brother in half in a freak machete accident. His brother's like, "You gotta be double great for both of us," and his father's like, "The wrong kid died," and like throughout the film he keeps telling Dewey, "The wrong kid died." And there's so much great stuff. There's an amazing clip. You should look for it on YouTube.
Smell.
Oh yeah, he went smell blind as well. But there's a great clip where to begin Dewey's descent into drugs, where he walks in on Tim Meadows doing smoking pot, and every time he discovers Tim Meadows doing drugs, Tim Meadows says the great thing about it and always ends with, "It's a nightmare. Get out of here." And Dewey ends up doing the drug anyway. And it's just an amazing thing. And it also, it makes fun of, people in music history. So Dewey will go through a Bob Dylan phase, or he'll go through a Daniel Wilson or a Brian Wilson phase. Brian Wilson phase. And just
didgeridoos.
Exactly. I need an army of didgeridoos. And the weird thing about Walk Hard, I loved it. The film flopped really hard. And that was sort of, it had Apatow's backing. I guess John C. Reilly wasn't a big enough star for them. but it's a fantastic movie. So I highly recommend checking out Walk Hard: The Dewey Cox Story and then buying the soundtrack, because the soundtrack is also amazing. So that's our recommendations. Thanks for listening. If you want to keep up with this podcast, you can follow us on Twitter. My Twitter handle is Matt Goldberg. Adam, where can we find you on Twitter?
At Adam Chitwood.
And Dave?
At Dr. Claw, MD.
All right, next week we will be talking about either Django Unchained or Les Mis, but I'm thinking Django Unchained because there's a lot there.
Django.
That also has a great soundtrack. You should totally pick that up. So thank you all for listening. Have a Merry Christmas, except for our Jewish listeners, in which case, have a good time getting Chinese food and going to the movies, as is my tradition, and the tradition set down in the Torah. So thanks for listening, everyone, and we'll be back with you next week.